Thank y'all, Nancy, Anna, thank you. The grandness of Easter is wonderful, of Easter worship. I've also, through the years, come to appreciate the Sunday after Easter. I call it Easter for introverts. We're still talking about the resurrection. We're still singing the songs of resurrection. There just aren't quite as many people. I like the intimate nature of the service on the Sunday after Easter, and I hope you do too. I'm glad that you're here today. Scripture tells us a good deal about the things that happened after the resurrection. It tells us things that happened on the day of resurrection, the evening of resurrection, which we're getting ready to read about. And then it gives us these pictures of the resurrected Jesus interacting with his disciples and other eyewitnesses over the course of several weeks. We're looking at one of those this morning, Luke 24. This is the day of resurrection, and so in verse 13, when it says that very day, it's saying that this is Sunday. That very day, two of them, two disciples, were going to a village named Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. And they were talking with each other about all these things that had happened. And while they were talking and discussing together, Jesus himself drew near and went with them. But their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And he said to them, "What is this conversation that you were holding with each other as you walk?" And they stood still, looking sad. Then one of them, named Cleopas, answered him, "Are you the only visitor in Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened there in these days?" And Jesus said to them, "What things?" And they said to him, "Concerning Jesus of Nazareth, a man who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and all the people, and how our chief priests and rulers delivered him up to be condemned to death and crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. Yes, and beside all this, it is now the third day since these things happened. Moreover, some women of our company amazed us. They were at the tomb early in the morning, and when they did not find his body, they came back saying that they had even seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. Some of those who were there with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they did not see him." Jesus said to them, "Oh, foolish ones, and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Was it not necessary that the Christ should suffer these things and enter into his glory?" And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. So they drew near to the village to which they were going. He acted as if he were going farther, but they urged him strongly, saying, "Stay with us, for it is toward evening, and the day is now far spent." So he went in to stay with them. When he was at table with them, he took the bread and blessed and broke it and gave it to them. And their eyes were opened and they recognized him. And he vanished from their sight. They said to each other, "Did not our hearts burn within us while he talked to us on the road, while he opened to us the scriptures?" And they rose that same hour and returned to Jerusalem, and they found the 11 and those who were with them gathered together, saying, "The Lord is risen, and he has appeared to Simon." Then they told what had happened on the road and how he was known to them in the breaking of the bread. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Through the years, I've noticed a growing skepticism toward the resurrection of Jesus. Almost everybody these days believes that he was a wonderful man, that he was a teacher, that he was a good role model, and most everybody agrees that he was indeed crucified on a cross, maybe because of those three things. But the discussion begins with the resurrection. Did the resurrection really happen? And that question should not surprise us. Paul, all the way back 2,000 years ago, says to the church in Corinth, that this resurrection is a stumbling block to those who come from the faith through Judaism, and it is foolishness to those who come to faith from being a Gentile. Scripture describes it this way, that humanity is like we have a veil over our eyes, keeping us from seeing the truth. And when we come to faith, that veil is lifted and we can see the truth. But for the world at large, things are at best fuzzy. There's no real clarity about the resurrection. And that's what this text is about today. On the road to Emmaus, two disciples have a veil over their eyes. But by the time they get to the end of this story, the veil has been lifted from their eyes, and they declare with certainty that Jesus is risen indeed. And so I think it's a good one for us to explore, because we get to go on this Emmaus road journey with these disciples. From fear, maybe disbelief, doubt, confusion, maybe even chaos, to meeting Jesus and then knowing the truth of the resurrection. There is something that moves these two disciples from a place of spiritual blindness into a place of sight. And that's what is before us. So let's just walk through the text. Beginning in verse 13, you see that it is still the day of resurrection. It's in the afternoon. A lot has happened. According to Luke, early in the morning, a group of women go to the tomb. They find the stone rolled away, two men, and dazzling clothes appear. And their message is, he's not here because he's risen. And the women go back and tell the disciples, but, especially Luke, the disciples, don't believe the women's testimony. Only Peter. And in the Gospel of John, we see that John goes to go out to look. The disciples at this point are confused. They don't know what to believe. All they have is the testimony of these two women. And the disciples count their testimony as an idle tale. They don't believe it. So now there's a scene change from the morning, and we're out on the road. It's afternoon, and these two disciples who are not in the inner circle. One of them is named Cleopas. It's the only time that the name is mentioned in Scripture, and the other is unnamed. They are traveling to a town called Emmaus. Emmaus is about 7 miles from Jerusalem. And as they walk along talking, Jesus draws near to them, but their eyes are kept from identifying him. And I think there's something there in the passive voice. Their eyes are kept. What it ought to tell us is that somebody is sovereign over this whole situation. Somebody is acting on these two disciples. And Jesus asks them, what are you talking about? Luke tells us that they stop and look sad. That's not a great way of telling us what the Greek tells us. They stop from their walking and they look sad. The language there is that their faces are disfigured. They are emotionally torn apart. They don't know what to do. They don't know what to think. They are clearly in mourning. And Cleopas replies, don't you know what's been going on? There was a man, Jesus of Nazareth. He was a great man. He was a prophet. And he was delivered up to be crucified. And you can notice a couple things here. The past tense tells us what Cleopas really believes. There was a man. I don't know if Cleopas is open to the idea that there still is a man. And just he downgrades Jesus. There was a man. We had hoped that he would be the Messiah. We had hoped that he would be the one to redeem Israel and fulfill all the prophecies. And you can see the disappointment in his voice as he describes it. There was a man. We thought he would do this, but all he did was this. And he continues, And to add to the anxiety, the women went to the tomb. They didn't find the body. They reported seeing angels who told them that Jesus is alive. But you can even hear the judgment of the testimony of women. We know they didn't find the body. But beyond that, who knows? And so Cleopas is in a tough spot here. And this might be good for us because we're sort of in the same spot that Cleopas is in. We've heard the news of what is possible, but we haven't seen it ourselves. All we have to go off is the word of others. And given that situation, Jesus speaks. Jesus isn't particularly patient with them at this point. And I kind of read this with a little bit of a smile on my face. Jesus rebukes them and calls them foolish and slow of heart to believe. I smile at that because Jesus has been to hell and back. He's walking along the road and they are still confused. I get Jesus is saying at this moment, come on. What do I have to do? Please understand. John Calvin, addressing this, says that Jesus is looking at the disciples and says to them, you too are extremely sluggish. So Jesus expounds, don't you know? Don't you know that what you're saying happened was supposed to happen? Don't you know that these things, they were the plan all along? And so Jesus, beginning with Moses and the prophets, he opens up the Hebrew Scriptures to them, and he explains all of the passages that pertain to him being the Messiah. We don't get a lot of the details about what they covered, but what a Bible study. I imagine Jesus talking to them and saying, do you remember when you were in slavery in Egypt and God heard the cries of the people in slavery and so he sent somebody down to announce delivery? Well, that's sort of like what the Messiah has done now. Moses was just foreshadowing. Or do you remember at that 10th plague when the lamb was sacrificed and the blood was taken and covered the doorpost? Did you know that you were saved by the blood of the lamb? Does any of that ring a bell for you? All of these things have happened according to a divine plan. Does Isaiah 7 ring a bell that the virgin will give birth and you will call him Emmanuel? Does Isaiah 9 ring true, that he'll be Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Prince of Peace? How about Isaiah 53, where the Messiah who comes is a suffering servant who will redeem by taking your brokenness upon his own shoulders, and by his wounds you will be healed? Maybe Jesus said things to them like, Does Micah 5 ring a bell for anybody, that this Messiah is going to be born in Bethlehem? What about Zechariah? This was a week ago, people, where Jesus comes into Jerusalem riding on a donkey. Zechariah said that would be an indication of the coming king. They still don't quite understand, but they're intrigued enough to invite him to stay with them overnight. And when they're gathered around the table, Jesus breaks bread, gives it to them, and their eyes are opened. The veil is lifted. They recognize him. And there's some mystery in this. When they recognize him, Jesus is gone. But their response to it, did our hearts not burn within us as we were walking through all of those explanations? And they're so convinced of what has happened that they make the dangerous trip back to Jerusalem that very night. They find the other disciples who already know that the Lord is risen. What we've done is been able to move with them from uncertainty into faith. And that's what's here. I think it teaches us a couple of things. One, again, the resurrection is true. And not only is the resurrection true, but it is necessary and it is central to the Christian life. That's why Paul is able to say, if the resurrection didn't happen, then you need to pity us because we are way off base. Everything points toward a resurrection. But what I want to spend some time on is the second thing that I think we can learn from this, not just the truth of the resurrection, but we're getting ready to see how God works in our lives to move us from unbelief or doubt or despair to a faith that is strong enough to testify. Because we're not born automatically believing. You may be born into a family of faith, but you don't automatically believe. Theologians call that the veil of original sin that is over our eyes. We can't see. We can know a lot about Jesus, but we can still not recognize or know Jesus because of the veil that is over our eyes. Maybe the most faithful, maybe the most important example of this beyond these two disciples is the Apostle Paul. The Apostle Paul, who knew all of those scriptures about the Messiah, and yet he was persecuting Christians until he came face to face with the risen Lord on the road to Damascus. He knew so much, but the veil still covered his eyes. In fact, you see that in his conversion, because when he meets Jesus, he's blinded, and later when he's able to see again, scales fall off of his eyes, and he's able to see and know the truth. You see what these two things have in common. It's what moves us from doubt and despair into faith. And it's one thing. It's meeting Jesus. So where or how do you meet Jesus? We have the testimony of others, but how do we meet him ourselves? I want to tell you about two ways. We meet Christ in Scripture. You notice in the story how the disciples are in the state of chaos because they don't know how to interpret the events and circumstances around them. They're trying to make sense of it, but the more they talk, the further into despair they go. And into that despair comes this survey of the Scriptures, and God uses these Scriptures to introduce the doubting disciples to the risen Christ. They meet Jesus through a study of Scripture. Their hearts burn as they hear the word, and their despair melts, and their assumptions are corrected. That's so important. What our tendency is in this life is to recreate Jesus in our image. Do you know what that means? It means that we want Jesus to be a bigger version of ourselves. If Jesus is Republican, we want a Republican Jesus. If Jesus is Democrat, we want a Democrat Jesus. If Jesus is, if we're Mexican, then we want a Mexican Jesus. If we're American, we want an American Jesus. Our tendency is to recreate Jesus in our image. And the only correction for that is we dive into Scripture to meet Jesus as he really is, not as we want Jesus to be. Meeting that Jesus challenges our assumptions and corrects us when we've gotten off track. That's what happens with these two disciples. We were hoping he was a Messiah, but he didn't Messiah the way that we wanted him to Messiah, so we must be wrong. You don't get to dismiss Jesus because he doesn't save in the way you want him to save, because he doesn't answer prayer in the way you want him to answer prayer. We meet the real Jesus as he's revealed to us in Scripture. And the second way is we meet the real Jesus in worship. I think that might be the winning point of this story. Is that around the table when they break bread, their eyes are opened and he is recognized. That's an act of worship. And guess what we're doing today? We're coming to the table. We're studying the Scriptures. We're asking God to remove the veil from our eyes so that we can see Jesus as he really is. We're even going to sing a song in a minute about asking Jesus to be revealed to us as we break bread. You know, there are a lot of reasons for coming to and being in worship. But I wonder how many of us have the idea and even the prayer that as we come into this room, more than anything else, we want an encounter with the risen Lord. There are a lot of motivations for being here. There are a lot of good and there are a lot of lesser motivations. We enjoy being in the fellowship of believers. We enjoy learning about things. We enjoy receiving even a little therapy to help us get through the week. We enjoy the habit and the consistency of being here. But you can do all of those things and not have an encounter with the risen Lord. What if when we walk in the door, our prayer is, above all else, I want to meet the real you today, Jesus. You know, the early church worshiped on Sunday because it was a day of resurrection and they wanted to perpetually remind themselves of the resurrection when they gathered for worship. But another reason was in these post-resurrection appearances, Jesus kept showing up. He kept opening their eyes to him and being present with them on the first day of the week. And so they started gathering together with the expectation, I wonder if Jesus is going to show up again this Sunday. That's our prayer as a church. That when we gather, we have the expectation that Jesus will show up. And here's how we think about these things in our lives. I guess I need to agree with John Calvin that We are excessively sluggish. A veil is over our eyes, and there are different degrees of this. Some people just outright disbelieve. Some people are overcome by worry and doubt, uncertainty. All of us can agree that there's a certain amount of chaos that exists in this world right now. And how do we move from there to faith and trust? And here it is. Through the Word being opened so that we meet the real Jesus. And through worship, as we're inviting the presence of the real Christ to lead us forward. I think that means for believers, Bible study is not optional. You're not going to have peace in your life. You're not going to grow in your life unless you are digging into the Scriptures, asking God to show you who He really is. As believers, worship, communal worship is not optional. You're not going to have peace in your life or grow if you're not regularly part of a worshiping community inviting the Lord to reveal Himself to you as He really is. I guess that's my invitation to you today. As we come to this table, as we share in the sacrament of the Lord's Supper, we are asking for God to show up through Jesus Christ. We are acknowledging that we have a need. We're acknowledging that we live with this cloudy vision that confuses us as we live in a confusing world. And we're praying, Lord, through the Word and through worship, will you show yourself to us as you really are so that we can have life and so that we can have peace? Friends, if that's the kind of thing that you are interested in today, then you are invited to come and to partake. If that's the kind of thing that is interesting to you, to grow in faith, to see Jesus as he really is, then you're invited to come to this table. I invite us together to affirm the faith of the church as we come to the table.